Welcome to 5-Minute Journal Club, Oral SERDS Edition. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. Today, meeting with Dr. Seth Wander from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston to discuss several recent papers, beginning with an article focusing on a strategic overview of the use of systemic therapy in patients with advanced hormone receptor-positive disease, including the use of non-endocrine-targeted therapies, including PARP inhibitors, chemotherapy, and ADCs in this specific patient population.
This is a really challenging topic to tackle, and it's really important because the field is shifting under our feet on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. And the way I think about it is almost all patients will get an aromatase inhibitor and a CDK and 4/6 inhibitor in the first line setting. And then it becomes really critically important at the time of progression to understand the molecular genomic profile of the tumor. About 40% of the patients will have PIK3CA or PIK3CA pathway alterations, many of which are truncal, meaning they're present at the time of metastatic diagnosis, particularly in PIK3CA itself. So if you're one of those 40 to 50% that have PI3K, AKT, P10, you can go down that pathway. And if you're ESR1 mutant, that number will creep up over time, depending on how many prior lines of therapy. We have an FDA approval now for elacestrant monotherapy. Fulvestrant is an option, and we have some data that fulvestrant is active in ESR1 mutants, but it's debatable kind of where fulvestrant is going to be most effective. And elacestrant is, of course, a pill. It's fairly easy to take. If you're BRCA mutant, then you have options for PARP inhibitors, which are highly active. And if somebody's BRCA mutant, I'm pretty keen to reach for one of those drugs, fairly early here because it is generally well tolerated and response rates are quite high. And then if you have no target, I would either use fulvestrant or I would think about using fulvestrant with continuation of CDK blockade, typically abemaciclib based on the postMONARCH study. And then once you've exhausted all of these endocrine options, or if the patient has more aggressive disease, we're thinking about either chemo or an antibody drug conjugate. The data from DESTINY-Breast06 that the antibody drug conjugate trastuzumab deruxtecan for a HER2 low or ultra low patient is more active than conventional chemotherapy. It becomes, I think, a really highly personalized decision because things like capecitabine are so tolerable as opposed to going into an IV every 3 weeks with the ADC. And also, as they mentioned, there's lots of new ADCs exploding onto the scene. We have Dato-DXd, we have HER3 antibody drug conjugates. There are many others, moving through phase 1 and phase 2. So it's a lot of options, which is good for patients, but it's pretty complicated for clinicians who aren't dealing with breast cancer 24/7.
Now we have triplet in some patients up front. What do we know about how that alters the mutational profile in terms of, biomarkers or response to therapy?
Yeah, fantastic question. And we really don't know much about the mutational profile at the time of progression on PI3K pathway inhibitors. We're just starting to obviously get that data in. And this is a question that I'm excited to talk with you about probably in the next 18 to 24 months as we start to parse some of that data both on and off clinical trials.
Just talk a little bit about the EMBER-2 study that was published in October. I love these preoperative window of opportunity studies. I wish there were more of them. They're so interesting.
Yeah, I share your feeling about this. These preoperative window of opportunity studies give us great kind of snapshots in time in a dynamic way where you have these perfectly paired pre and post tumor biopsies. And you can learn a lot about the biology of the molecule and who's responding and who's not responding without having to do these huge studies and kind of be reading the tea leaves in the metastatic setting. EMBER-2 is preoperative with the next generation oral SERD imlunestrant. Patients had stage 1 to 3 breast cancer, hormone receptor ER positive, HER2 negative. They were operable, but they were untreated. They hadn't had any prior therapy. So they had a baseline biopsy, and then they were randomized to 3 different doses of the oral SERD imlunestrant between 200 and 800 milligrams. They had treatment for 15 days, and then they went for surgery, or they had a second biopsy. I think many of them went to surgery. And you can see the drop in ER, the drop in PR, and the drop in Ki-67 proliferation marker. And the drug was highly effective at all the different doses on the order of about 70 to 90%. And what we can then do, which we haven't seen that data yet, is say, well, okay, what's unique about the subgroup of these patients who had the deepest response? And what's unique about the subgroup of these patients, the few of them who didn't really respond at all? Was there a secondary mutation? Is there some unique ESR1 variant there that we haven't fully appreciated or elaborated? I think those are the really exciting and interesting questions.
Since it was primary breast cancer, I'm assuming very few of these patients actually had ESR1, and yet you Right. still see these kind of responses. How do they compare indirectly to, say, what you would see with an AI?
Yeah, it's a great question. You definitely see response with an AI, but anecdotally, I don't think it's quite as brisk and as deep. And to your point also, you're absolutely right. You would not expect a huge number of ESR1. This also suggests, to your point, that this type of drug might be active in ESR wild type population. And we haven't seen data yet from EMBER-3 and from some of these large prospective studies. The safety data from EMBER-2 matches what we've seen from other phase one efforts in the metastatic setting. These drugs are generally very tolerable. There are, I think, some more GI toxicities, low grade for the most part, a little bit of nausea, a little bit of loose stool, very few high grade toxicities. And one of the things I draw your attention to, really rare arthralgia in these cohorts compared to, for example, what we experience on aromatase inhibitors. This to me is one of the most common limiting features of an aromatase inhibitor. It can be really debilitating joint pain in a meaningful subset of patients. We're also participating in the EMBER-4 study where patients with slightly higher risk disease, these were patients, they get between 2 and 5 years on standard endocrine therapy. This is a big study, more than 6,000 people international. And then they get randomized 1-to-1 to either continue for another 5 years their current therapy or switch over to imlunestrant. Now, to your question, we're going to learn a lot there about toxicity and how well they feel when they make the switch. And I've already had probably 20 patients on this study. And as I said, anecdotally, it tends to be really well tolerated. We don't know whether switching to a next generation oral SERD is going to be, number one, more tolerable, and number two, more effective.
The next paper is from the 2024 ESMO meeting, one of many recent efforts to develop a standardized approach to detecting ESR1 resistance mutations in liquid biopsy samples.
This is a really nice study, and it's kind of addressing a newer version of the technology to detect ESR1 alterations. The need here is, what does it mean when we detect these alterations at really small frequencies, like extremely low, you know, allelic fractions? And there's been a push to start to understand that better so that we can choose when to use these drugs. We can start to anticipate what the prognosis is going to be, what the progression pattern is going to be. Now, it's not quite that simple as you might expect. Some mutations have neomorphic activities. Some of them turn the receptor on more than others. And so not all of these mutations are created equal, which is a theme we're going to be talking more and more about over the next year or two. But broadly speaking, they've created this assay where they're looking at these frequent alterations. So they extract not just cell-free DNA, but also the exosomal RNA. This is meant to be rapid, highly sensitive, cost-effective way to build upon the technology that already exists to detect these ESR1 variants in a highly sensitive manner. And I think these type of tools where we can turn it around quickly, where we understand the frequency of these alterations, and you can look in the same patient over time and see whether that allelic fraction is the same, is rising, is falling. This is a really important unmet need.
So can you kind of talk more about what's available now in terms of the ESR1 mutations, what options clinicians have in terms of how they're going to get this assay done?
Yeah. So you can either do a solid tumor biopsy and then sequence with conventional targeted sequencing. One of the key mistakes that gets made here, though, is a clinician might have a patient who's progressing on first-line therapy, metastatic ER positive. Maybe they reach back for the archival specimen, either from the primary tumor or the time of metastatic diagnosis, and they say, I'm going to sequence this, and there's no ESR1. And so the mistake here is to reach back in a past-looking way to an archival and miss an ESR1 that may have been acquired. So most of the guidelines and most conventional use here suggests using liquid biopsy, circulating tumor DNA for ESR1. One of the problems is sometimes the broader you go, the less deep you're able to go with each specific gene in terms of the sequencing. Whereas some of these emerging tools, they may only be looking at a small spectrum of alterations in one gene, but they can go extremely, extremely deep where you can start to detect those allelic fractions at a level that a conventional test would never report. So those are the things we need to think about